This is Fresh Air. Wendell Berry lives a kind of life that is dying out in America. He's a small farmer, the sixth generation of his family to work the land in Kentucky. He's also keeping alive the spirit of the small farm through his writing. His fiction is about farmers and small rural communities. And he's written many essays about the deteriorating relations between the country and the city in America. His books include A Place on Earth, Nathan Coulter, What Are People For?, and a new collection of short stories called Fidelity. Wendell Berry teaches at the University of Kentucky. He says that America has turned its countryside into a third world colony.
The countryside is now in a situation in which it's underrepresented politically. And for the most part, it buys on markets that are inflated and sells on markets that are depressed. And for the most part, it controls neither market. And so the countryside is now being used simply for what can be got out of it for the benefit of people who aren't in the countryside. And that, to me, is the definition of a colony.
You've said that our society is suffering, people have no connection to the land, and those that do are dismissed as hicks or yokels.
Yes.
Does that connect to what you just said?
Yes. The vast population of consumers that we have now give a proxy for food production and the production of other products to a relatively small, really an unprecedentedly small population of land users. And like any other proxy that's given, this one has to be properly supervised. It has to be knowledgeably supervised, or else it becomes ruinous. And the fact is now that the vast majority of our population is using the land by a proxy that they don't supervise and that they are incompetent to supervise. And this, to me, explains the damage that's being done to the land and the people of the land.
When you talk of the colonizing of the countryside, are you talking about agribusiness?
Yes. I'm talking about those forces that are usually described by the term the market.
Now, you've said that you won't eat agribusiness-grown food. You like to eat, quote, vegetables and fruits that you know have lived happily and healthily in good soil.
Well, I'm not a fanatic or an absolute purist. Of course, when I'm traveling, I eat whatever I can, whatever's available. And in our household, we buy some food, but for the most part, we produce our own food. And for the most part, the food that we have produced has lived a very good life.
Now, you are, I believe, the sixth generation of your family to live in Henry County, Kentucky.
Yes, that's right.
And you've had your farm for 27 years. Would you describe your farm for us?
My farm is a very marginal hill farm that has only about 15 acres of arable land on it. And the rest of it is either in permanent pasture or woodland. And it's mainly a subsistence farm. We use it to grow our own food, and we take our own firewood from it. But we also have a small flock of sheep, and we market a few lambs every year. It's not a representative farm of my part of the country at all. It's not a commercial farm.
Now, you returned to Kentucky after studying or teaching at NYU, New York University.
Yes, I was teaching.
You were teaching there. Why did you decide to go back?
Well, I was invited to come back and teach in my own university, the University of Kentucky. This was in 1964. And when I had an opportunity to come back, it seemed to me the right thing to do for better reasons than I was aware of at the time, I think. But it has turned out, I think, to have been the right thing for me to do.
When you returned to Kentucky, did you expect to lead the university life and the literary life, or did you know that you would start a farm, too?
I expected to live the life of a university teacher, really. And we bought a place near where my family lived on the Kentucky River that we thought we would use as a second home. And it wasn't long before we realized that we didn't want a second home. We wanted an only home, and we wanted that to be it.
How did you get involved into farming? And that includes raising animals and growing food. I mean, this is a lot of work we're talking about.
Yes, it's a good deal of work. I was raised a farmer. And my father, who was a lawyer, had always also been a farmer and had been involved in agricultural politics. And he taught me to regard myself as a farmer, and I'd always wanted to farm. I never wanted to be apart from it. And I've always been happiest when I've had that work to do. And so it came about naturally, given those origins.
Now, I know that you see your work in a way as a return to traditional values, but I wonder if your neighbors or even your family considers you to be an eccentric.
Well, I haven't asked them if they consider me to be an eccentric or not, but my belief is that I'm on fairly good terms with my neighbors and my family.
I guess when I ask about being seen as an eccentric, what I'm referring to is I'd imagine you use a lot less technology than the neighboring farms in Kentucky.
Well, I use, to some extent, different technology. I keep a team of horses and do most of my farm work with that team. But that doesn't mean that I scruple to have help from people with tractors when I need it.
Why do you do it? Why do you have horses instead of a tractor?
Well, I like horses better than I like a tractor. it interests me a great deal to use to work with horses. I've always loved horses, and since I'm able to do it, it pleases me very much to do as much of my work as I do without an expenditure of fossil fuel and the other things that there's no air pollution from horses, and it just satisfies me in a way that I need to be satisfied.
Let me ask you about this. In your area of Kentucky, there's a lot of tobacco that's grown, and your
yes.
father, in fact, was the president of a tobacco growers association.
Yes,
and of course
so
now,
my brother.
Yeah, and now since we've learned so much about the hazards of smoking, there's a lot of controversy surrounding every aspect of tobacco. So we have this area in which agricultural values and health values kind of come into conflict. How has that affected your family, which has been so involved with tobacco growing?
Well, of course, we're aware of the conflict and the difficulty. The position that we've taken, or I should speak only for myself, my own position is that the farmers should not be destroyed in order to destroy the crop. What we need to do is give a choice to the tobacco farmers to grow another crop that would pay as well as tobacco. And at present, we don't have that choice. That is, the tobacco farmers don't have that choice. They've not been given such a choice. And so what they're doing in choosing to grow tobacco is choosing to survive. It's mm-hmm. as simple as that.
My guest is writer Wendell Berry. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Wendell Berry. He lives on his farm in Kentucky. He uses traditional farming methods and uses very little modern technology. What are some of the things that you think are kind of common in 20th century society? Types of technology or other related things that other people use a lot or do a lot that you really don't want as part of your life?
Well, we have a furnace in our house, for instance, but we also have wood stoves. We put the furnace in because we hadn't yet begun to think about the energy economy. And we still use the furnace some as a sort of backup system for the wood stoves. But to a considerable extent, we heat our house with firewood that we've cut on our own place and hauled into the woodshed. A lot of people now, apparently, I judge from questions I get, know that I don't use a computer to write with. And these refusals come about simply because I either don't see a need for the technology, or I'm too pleased with the technology I already have to want to change. And I don't believe in substituting expensive solutions for cheap ones ever.
Well, in the article that you wrote about why you won't use a computer, one of the reasons was that you don't want your work as a writer dependent on strip-mined coal.
Yes.
But you also wrote in there, and this ended up being very controversial, you wrote, "My wife types my work on a Royal Standard bought in 1956. As she types, she sees things that are wrong and marks them with small checks in the margin." You got a lot of angry mail in response to that because people thought, well, sure, you've got a wife that does your job, and they interpreted that as a pretty kind of sexist solution to editing. But also, as you know, sure, if everybody had somebody who was going to do all their typing for them, they wouldn't need computers either.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to the angry response that was generated by this article you wrote?
Well, my response to it was that the anger was illogical because they had no evidence to support their claims that it was sexist, and that it the anger also revealed a rather sad failure to understand that people both need help and are sometimes glad to give help. And it seemed to me particularly distressing that people who were taking what they supposed was a feminist approach to what I said were willing to think the worst of my wife.
You mean that she was just there as a helpmate?
That she had not enough sense to refuse to help me if she didn't want to, for one thing. But they all assumed that she was some kind of slave, an assumption for which I'd provided no evidence whatsoever.
You know what I think a lot of people would probably like to know? When you make the choice to not use a computer, does that mean you disapprove of others who do use one? When you make your choice to grow your own farm, you know, grow your own food, does that mean you disapprove of people who live in cities and don't grow their own food?
No. What I disapprove of, because I'm afraid of it, is incompetent, uninformed consumption. People who use things without knowing or attempting to know where they come from, how they're produced, or what damage may be done to people or land in the course of production.
You know, it's very easy when you live in a city to not think a lot about farms and to not think a lot about the countryside, although you eat a lot of vegetables. And if you're
yes.
a meat eater, you eat a lot of meat and, you know,
yes.
The animals are, being bred somewhere on a farm. Do you think that city people should take more responsibility for what's happening to the American countryside because whether they live there or not, they are eating the
yes,
product of it?
That's right. I think they should become more involved, and this is something I'm trying to become competent to talk about. The ancient Greeks thought of a polity as a city and its tributary countryside, and that seems to me to be a reasonable approach to this issue. A sound, safe supply of food is inevitably going to be a supply of food that is, so far as possible, a local supply. And so what I'm trying to encourage is conversation and commerce between city people and farmers in their local landscape. This, of course, can happen and is happening on a personal basis, but it could be made to happen much more effectively if churches and conservation groups in the cities would begin to talk to those small organizations that represent the small farmers in their area.
Are you doing work like that in your area, trying to make connections between small farmers and people living in nearby cities?
Well, we ourselves always sell our lambs to private customers.
In the area?
In the area, in nearby cities and towns and so forth. And there are, I think, nearly everywhere in the country now, farmers who are dealing privately with a set of customers who, in effect, subscribe to their farm and receive in return a basket of fresh produce or whatever once a week, for instance.
Wendell Berry, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Wendell Berry's new book is a collection of short stories called Fidelity. This is Fresh Air.